I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The FBI and other authorities today searched several properties, including a city hall office linked to the politically powerful labor leader John Daugherty. While investigators won't reveal exactly what they're looking for, the property searchers have again raised the question about whether the man known as Johnny Doc could be facing federal charges. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports.
FBI agents strolled into Johnny Doc's modest brick South Philly home and walked out with his computer and box after box of his possessions. Authorities also made seizures at the home base of the electricians' union local he oversees, at the bar he runs, and at the city hall office of Councilman Bobby Heenan, who used to be the union's political director. Daugherty says he's not worried.
I've been doing this for 25 years, and I've had many, many subpoena and many, many visits. You know, I'm on my 25th year. I'm not making rookie mistakes.
Wearing a button-down white shirt and a 76ers hat, Daugherty paced back and forth in front of his home, conferring with his attorney, family, and friends. He seemed a little anxious. Federal law enforcement officials took him inside of his house and questioned him for about 20 minutes. Right before it started, he opened all of his blinds, allowing reporters to gawk at the scene. About a decade ago, the feds conducted searches at his house, but it never triggered any charges. It was later revealed that the investigation got started after the feds noticed home renovations that Daugherty never reported to the IRS. He says this time around, investigators can look all they want.
The house is exactly the same since the last time I had 75 people here. You know, the house is exactly the same except for a few new tomato bushes.
A few doors down lives Linda Campbell, one of Doc's longtime neighbors. She says he's been railroaded by the feds.
They got it in for him. Why? I don't know. It's a shame. He's a great guy. He really is.
Another neighbor, Animal Downey, echoes that feeling.
He's a good union man. He truly is. Wonderful wages. They make wonderful wages. They build beautiful buildings. What more could you want?
Do the feds have it out for the man because he runs Local 98, the biggest spender in Pennsylvania politics? I asked him that.
I don't know. You guys will figure that out. Maybe I win too much.
Politically speaking, he does win a lot, says Zach Stahlberg. He used to lead the government watchdog group Committee of 70.
He's a natural target for ambitious prosecutors because he's the big enchilada.
Stahlberg says before Daugherty, Local 98 was a traditional trade union, and it didn't wield much influence. But when Doc stepped in, the union became a real powerhouse in politics.
As he grew over time, he became very smart at creating alliances, at putting friends in high places. The best example would probably be Kenny in the mayor's office and Daryl Clark as the head of city council.
Stahlberg says Daugherty is the smartest politician in Philadelphia. There's just one catch. He doesn't have a political job. He exerts power behind the scenes. Mayor Jim Kenney has strong ties to Daugherty and won his endorsement in last year's mayoral primary. When asked if he thinks the raids will make voters think less of him because of his ties to Daugherty, Kenney replied,
"They can think what they want."
And many will, as they wait to see if this investigation yields any charges. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
And this disclosure, Daugherty's union, Local 98, represents engineers at WHYY. More than 100 angry residents packed a South Jersey gym last night to vent their frustrations with Verizon. It came after at least 16 towns formally asked the state to investigate poor telephone and internet service in rural South Jersey. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
It was the first public meeting about trouble with Verizon service in South Jersey since the issue recently exploded, and a lot of people from the area took the time to come out and ask the company, "Can you hear us now?" Teresa Duffy Diamond of Cedarville owns her own business, and her Verizon bill is about $200 per month.
Yeah, I have issues whether it rains, whether it snows, whether there's wind outside, or even when it's sunny. And I have a demonstration here of an example of a voicemail message from a client. You let me know what you can hear.
Resident after resident stood at the microphone in Estelle Manor Elementary School to recount dropped calls, static on their landline phones during bad weather, and slow internet speeds. But some people also directed their ire at the Board of Public Utilities, the state agency that regulates Verizon's landline and internet business. Joe Vander, a 20-year resident of Estelle Manor, blamed the BPU for allowing the problems to get so bad.
And you know what? Another thing, too, I'm not one of these politicians that are going to come up here and kiss you guys' butts. Because you know what? You've got to do your job. You haven't been doing your job. You're afraid of a rising. And if you were doing your job, we wouldn't have to sit here for the last 3 hours and listen to all this bull.
Also there were more than a dozen Verizon employees, including engineers who met with some of the speakers to try to address their issues. Spokesman Ray McConville said that showed that the company was paying attention.
Any service issue we take seriously. And obviously, you know, as you saw today, like there are people who think this is a problem. And if they think it's a problem, we're going to take that seriously and we're going to listen. And we're not just going to go home and sit on our hands.
The BPU will now consider the public comments and decide how to proceed. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
A struggling slice of North Philadelphia is getting a brand new supermarket. The deal announced this week is part of a $500 million revitalization effort already underway in the neighborhood. WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports.
A Save-A-Lot grocery store will rise on what's now a vacant grass lot at the intersection of Ridge Avenue and Jefferson Street in the Sharswood neighborhood. The discount supermarket chain will lease part of the 4.5-acre plot from the Philadelphia Housing Authority. Larry Redekin is acting general counsel at PHA. He says the 10-year deal is a critical piece of the agency's work remaking the neighborhood.
The community really told us that they wanted healthy food, produce, and meats at an affordable price.
And nearby. Right now, the closest supermarket is a half mile away. For Francis Ferguson, that's everything.
Senior citizens like myself, it's, you know, good for me to even take a walker. You know, it's real convenient for us.
Longtime resident Wayne Williams supports a supermarket coming to the neighborhood. He's not as thrilled about Save-A-Lot.
Why not a decent market? There you go, man. Not putting down Save-A-Lot, but I think a ShopRite should be here. You know, we got a fresh grocer up there with Temple, for Temple students.
Construction is slated to begin in early 2017 for a spring 2018 opening. PHA's headquarters, also on Ridge, will be built at the same time. Both projects are part of an ambitious 10-phase transformation plan that's included demolishing two public housing high-rises. Redekin with PHA says the agency is still in the process of securing the rest of the $500 million needed to finish the entire project. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Summertime and the living is easy. Perhaps too easy if measured by consumption. Let's get into it with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hi, hello, Dave.
What are Americans' habits during the summer of 2016?
65%. How's that for a number?
Which number does that represent?
That is the percent of Americans who say they at least occasionally drink alcoholic beverages. And the way we've asked that question over the years is, or are you a total abstainer? We used to say back in the South, a teetotaler. Do the math, that leaves about a third, 35% of Americans who claim they never drink alcohol. George Gallup asked this question in 1939 in the Depression for the first time, and back then it was 58% who said they drank alcohol and 42% who didn't. But over the years, this percentage of about 60-65% of Americans who say they drink has held fairly constant, even though we've had major demographic changes in the U.S. population.
Now there's drinking, and then there's drinking. How many drinks?
3.9. That's the average per week that Americans claim they drink. And that's been about the same since we've been tracking. It goes up and down periodically. Only 3% of Americans, by the way, Dave, claim that over the last week they've had 20 or more drinks. That would be 3 a day.
What percent say it's a little bit too much of a temptation?
1/4 of Americans who drink say sometimes they indulge too much. And we look back over time. We started asking this question when Jimmy Carter was president back in 1978, and he was 23% back then. So that number, again, is held fairly constant. It's not something that's really gone up and down. A different question that Gallup's been asking going all the way back to the 40s, always rate these things by president. This would have been when Harry Truman was president in 1947. 15% of Americans said drinking had been a cause of trouble in their family. And now we have 33% who say it's been a cause of trouble in their family. So actually the percent of Americans who are at least willing to admit or tell us that drinking can be a problem is up to about 1 out of 3 Americans.
Now, Frank, the broad categories are typically beer, wine, booze.
43% of Americans say that beer is their beverage of choice. 32% say it's wine, and 20% say it's spirits or liquor. We've been asking the question in this format since the early 1990s. And there have only been a few years during that time period when wine has actually come out ahead. Liquor never comes out ahead. But beer wins again in terms of being the beverage of choice among Americans.
Let's switch over now to smoking. I presume that is still in decline.
It is. 19% is our number. The government puts it out every year as well, and it roughly comes in with the same figure that we do. But that's 19% of adults who would be 18 and older who tell us that they have smoked any cigarettes in the last week. The highest point that we have found in our Gallup data of tracking this was 45% back in 1954 of Americans who said they smoked.
And for those who are trying to quit, how many say it takes on the first try?
Relatively few. Most smokers say they wish they could quit, and most smokers have tried to quit. Only about one out of five smokers say they've never tried to quit. 3.8 is the mean number. In other words, the person listening right now who's smoking has tried about four times at least to quit smoking to this point, and obviously hasn't been successful, at least hasn't been able to stop smoking. So there's a big, fascinating sentiment out there among smokers that they are aware of the fact that they shouldn't be doing what they're doing. It's not good for them. They try to stop, but obviously addiction is addiction, and it's very, very difficult for many to stop.
Toward that end, is there a groundswell of support for those trying to make tobacco illegal?
There is not. It's kind of like questions that we ask about abortion and gun control. Americans are very loath to say make something totally illegal. Maybe they remember prohibition where it simply didn't work. Americans are clearly inclined to say, yeah, we can make smoking illegal in public places, but very few Americans say it should be made totally illegal.
And as more and more states contemplate or indeed make various forms of marijuana consumption legal, is there an increased American appetite for that?
13% of Americans say that they currently smoke marijuana. And back in 2013, when we asked that same marijuana question, it was 7%. So we've had almost a doubling, if you want to look at it that way, of Americans who tell us they smoke marijuana.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Still ahead this evening, women's field hockey is alive and thriving in central Pennsylvania.
You ever watch women's USA soccer and how popular they are? And they weren't always like that, and they got there. And that's kind of a goal for ours, is to become that popular where little kids all over the U.S. are saying, like, I want to be the next Caitlin Fulgowski. I want to be the next Rachel Dawson.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. This weekend, a film festival will debut four short films about the Great Migration, a period in the early 20th century when African Americans moved in large numbers from the South to the North. The films are the tip of an iceberg. From WHYY's Arts and Culture desk, Peter Crimmins reports on the start of a year-long project about the transformation of Philadelphia.
1916, 100 years ago, was the start of the first wave of the Great Migration. That's when 1.6 million people, mostly black, moved from the agrarian South to the industrial North to find jobs. And churches were a big part of that. One of the biggest churches at the time was Tindley Temple, a United Methodist church in what is now the Graduate Hospital neighborhood of Philadelphia. At one point, over 10,000 people were in the congregation, in large part because of the Reverend Charles Tindley, who wrote scores of gospel hymns, some of which are still popular today.
Ever since I have been.
That is Pops Staples covering Tindley's A Better Home. The artist couple Mendy and Keith Obadike used that song as the basis of a sound and video installation.
I've started out to find a better home.
They recorded the temple structure itself by putting vibration sensors directly on the wooden rafters.
We recorded the structure of the church. We made audio recordings, but we also filmed the architecture. So when you see the video, the focus is very much on the things that hold the building up.
They focused on the structure because in a very real way, the temple was supported by its congregants. Hundreds of people, many of them migrants from the South, paid for the building of that temple by mortgaging their own homes. That sound installation is now at the Slott Foundation at 40th and Walnut Streets. The story of huge numbers of people changing the fabric of Philadelphia is the point of the Great Migration, A City Transformed. It's a multi-part initiative by the Scribe Video Center in West Philadelphia. The founder of Scribe Video, Louis Messiah, asked artists to focus on large groups of people and not necessarily the leaders of those people or their heroes.
Yes, individuals are make up communities and individuals may lead organizations, but it's really rooted in communities.
Messiah commissioned 4 films about what the Great Migration did to communities, which will be screened at the Black Star Film Festival this weekend at the International House in West Philly. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
After finishing last in the 2012 Olympic Games in London, the U.S. women's field hockey needed a reboot. The team packed up and moved from Southern California to rural central Pennsylvania. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that returning to field hockey's Mid-Atlantic roots is paying off, both in the team's ranking and in its growing fan base.
1,800 spectators isn't a big crowd for, say, a professional football game or even a college volleyball championship. But for elite women's field hockey in the United States, this is huge.
You got it, girl.
In fact, players and team staff say it's 10 times more people than a game at their old home in Chula Vista, California would draw. If you're not familiar with field hockey, it's kind of like watching soccer, but played with a curved stick and a small rubber ball. A sea of Team USA fans wearing red T-shirts have packed the bleachers, some driving hours to Lancaster County in the heart of Pennsylvania Dutch country to see the U.S. women play Team India.
For us to move to Pennsylvania was huge because we're closer to our field hockey community.
Captain Lauren Crandall is from Doylestown in Bucks County. The move back to the Mid-Atlantic was a homecoming of sorts for her and over half of the Olympic team, who hail from Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. It's also the area where the sport first caught fire in the United States and where people are still really enthusiastic about field hockey. That community provided a supportive place for team members to lick their wounds and regroup following their disappointing finish in the 2012 London Olympics. Here's Crandall again.
You have big goals, you have big aspirations, and we fell short of that. We finished last. And you just, when you go back, you want to just move things around and be like, oh, we should have done this, we should have done this.
Spearheaded by a new coach, former British field hockey Olympian Craig Parnham, the women doubled down on training, focusing on speed and team unity. In addition to an appreciative fan base, Lancaster provided something else the team didn't have before, a state-of-the-art indoor dome. They play at Spooky Nook, a giant private sports complex in Lancaster built by Sam Byler, the former owner of Annie Ann's Pretzel Company. Spooky Nook spokeswoman Alyssa Matangos leads a tour of the facility.
The only other country that has the exact same dome is in Mannheim, Germany. That type of dome is so special because it's temperature controlled, so it always stays at least 70 degrees, and then the turf inside is watered.
The water is key. Professional field hockey is played on artificial turf that's been hosed down to make the ball move quickly. At Spooky Nook, water cannons act like giant sprinklers, shooting jets across the field during breaks in play. Some combination of more fan support, better training, and a new location has made a big difference. Since that last place Olympic finish in 2012, the U.S. women's field hockey team has climbed to 5th in the world.
It's very easy to see that the women's national team is significantly better.
Adam Andrasco, member services director for the U.S. Field Hockey Association, says having a team that wins and a place that watches field hockey has helped with the business side.
We are having more and more series, and with those series we are selling tickets. Central Pennsylvania lends us the opportunity to be able to sell a higher volume of tickets than other areas of the country.
That's a big deal for a sports association that operates on less than $10 million a year in the U.S. Across the globe, field hockey is undergoing a made-for-TV transformation. The international governing body, the FIH, has been tailoring the rules to speed up play and make it easier for spectators to see what's going on.
Say hello to national television.
Team USA goalie Jackie Briggs says, sure, there are commercial benefits to growing the game, but it's also about sharing what the team has poured their lives into with more people.
You ever watch women's USA soccer and how popular they are? And they weren't always like that, and they got there, and that's kind of a goal for ours, is to become that popular where little kids all over the U.S. are saying, like, I want to be the next Caitlin Fulgowski, I want to be the next Rachel Dawson.
Those are players on the U.S. national field hockey team. Briggs, who grew up about 45 minutes away from Lancaster, already has fans. For the game against India, her old high school team from Berks County came to watch. Her old coach, Ann Schmidt, sitting in the stands, says seeing one of her own go to the Olympic Games is surreal.
It really is. You know, we have a big display at school with her pads and her jersey and, you know, a whole display for her. So she's making history and we're really excited for her.
She got to watch the U.S. women's team beat India 3-2 that night, the start in a series that was just a warm-up for their first Olympic match on Saturday. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. We had help this week from Ty Johnson. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks and Diana Martinez. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. A fond farewell and best of luck to our college intern this summer, Edward Saakashvili. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.